All right, folks, we are back up and streaming live. Is everybody present? Let's do a roll call. Miss Payne, are you there? Okay, how about Miss Green?
I'm here.
Okay. Miss Lewis?
Here.
Miss Pemberton? I'm sorry?
I'm here.
Okay. Miss Richardson? Mr. Horn? Miss Anthony? Okay. So we are missing four persons.
Alice, maybe we can just give them 5 minutes and we start at 10 past.
Okay, we'll do that.
Just 5 minutes.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi. Who's back?
Hi, I'm here.
Oh, Mr. Thomas. Okay, you're back. Okay. Who's there? That's Miss Richardson?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Horn, you there?
I'm here.
Thank you. Miss Anthony?
I'm here.
Miss Payne?
Yes. Yes.
Thank you. All right, so this afternoon we have joining us is Mr. Stephen Thomas. And he would be presenting on the topic Basics of Equity and Bond Markets. But we welcome Mr. Thomas.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Okay. Hi everyone and good afternoon, and it's a pleasure to be here. So I'm just going to go through, I think, what are some critical or some important points with respect to bonds and equity markets. But what I'd like to say from the start is, if anybody has any questions as we go along, because as you can see, it's a pretty lengthy presentation, which I don't necessarily want to go into a particular page. But what I would say is, if you have questions as we go along, it probably is better to interrupt rather than save it for the end. All right. Does anybody have any questions before we begin? No? Okay. Well, I'll take that as a no, and let's begin. So everybody can see the screen and everybody can hear me fairly okay, I trust.
Yes.
All right, great, no problem. So let's begin. So basics of bonds and equity markets. So if we could start.
Before you begin, I think what we're seeing is your secondary screen.
Uh-huh.
Where you have your notes and so on, and not necessarily the presentation screen.
Which is interesting because I thought I had my primary screen up. And come on. There's that blue credit screen again. There we are.
Yes, we can see it now.
Okay. All right, great. I'm having a small challenge, but okay, let's start. So I'm going to go through equities first, and then I'm going to do the fixed income section afterwards. So without further ado, and I trust that everybody would have seen a course content or course outline of what we're going to be covering. So I'm pretty much going to try and follow that particular outline and just really kind of go through with you what I think are the main topics, which you should try and focus on, and just really go through the information. So with that said, sources of equity financing. So what I've tried to do is essentially identify for you guys, like I said, what are the main sources of equity financing and essentially where they would come from. So equity, for example, can be used to do a few things. Pay with dividends to shareholders, expand existing business operation, buy back existing shares or retire debt within a particular company, or finance activities of this room, either short-term, which is working capital, or long-term in terms of amalgamations and joint ventures. So if you think about the balance sheet a little bit, there is a place that we can look towards to see where equity would come from, and that would be retained earnings. So the retained earnings of a company is a source of equity that is available to the company to essentially do these particular activities. And retained earnings, as we would appreciate and know, is the accumulation of profits over time that the business has enjoyed. But outside of that, we have a couple of places where we would also be able to get equity outside of the firm. And outside of the firm, there is going to be the issuance of common shares via the public capital market, either through an initial public offering or a secondary public offering. Additionally, we can look at other sources of equity from a few other places. There are a couple of places, for example, business angel investors or venture capital financing, or what is more commonly available these days, which is crowdfunding. And I think it's fairly descriptive. What I've tried to do here is give you a bit of a description as to what each of these are. So angel investors are essentially fairly well-to-do individuals or wealthy individuals that come in and essentially will partner with the business to see it grow over time. So think of the angel investors as the common example of, I think we have seen a program on TV called Shark Tank, which essentially is these panel of individuals that would look at companies, invest in companies for return of the profit of the business. There are also opportunities for venture capital financing, which is private equity financing, which is the ability to generate or derive larger sums of funds to participate or invest in a particular company. And then I think we would be fairly comfortable or see examples of crowdfunding where via the internet, persons throw up a website and say, listen, you can please go fund me, or you can essentially contribute to a particular activity or funding goal. So these are all examples of sources of equity financing. Features of equity financing, they're permanent in nature. They are essentially the owners of companies, and essentially they bear the remainder risk of the company. Equity shares are transferable, which means that they can go from one party to another without, with or without consideration. So they can be granted or gifted, or they can be sold via an exchange. Some equities do have a dividend attached to them, which is an appropriation of profit. Equity shareholders may or may not get a consistent fixed dividend. It all depends on the management decision of the firm. And the equity shareholders have a right to control the affairs of the company. And the opportunity to comment on those affairs of the company usually takes place during the annual general meeting of the firm or via some special extraordinary meeting that may take place over time. Additionally, the liability of equity shareholders is limited to the extent of the investment. So if you spend $100 on the shareholding of a particular company, then what is at risk at that point in time, it's only $100. You can't lose more than that $100. And what I've tried to identify here very quickly for you is a sample or essentially a listing of equity instruments as well as fixed income instruments. So as you would appreciate, common shares or common stocks and preferred stocks, depository receipts are pretty much what we see in terms of equity instruments that we would be pretty much familiar with. And then on the fixed income side, we have some banking products, savings accounts and certificates of deposit, which are in fact fixed income instruments, simply because there is the opportunity to invest or earn a return of interest or interest income on those instruments in the same way that we can earn interest on repurchase agreements, commercial paper, government bonds, notes, bills, international bonds, corporate bonds, or any type of bond structure. So again, the features of common stocks represent ownership of a particular company. One share entitles you to a vote on matters of expected corporate governance. Equities tend to be fairly liquid and traded on exchange, as you would appreciate in the Eastern Caribbean securities market. I believe that you have 13 listed companies on the exchange. And as you would appreciate, there are some names that you'd be familiar with. First Caribbean is one. Cable and Wireless is probably another one as well that I'm familiar with. And they are essentially are tightly held or can be tightly held. They can be publicly traded. They can be illiquid. They can be more liquid than others. So essentially, it all depends on the dynamics of a particular market or an exchange. But essentially, common stocks tend to trade on an exchange. Shareholders via the annual general meeting do get to elect board members who oversee the management of the company, who are geared or supposed to act in the best interest of those same said shareholders. I would have mentioned before that the shareholders do have a right to the residual claims of the firm, meaning that the stockholders are the last line in terms of receiving any claim on the assets or incomes of the company. They would rank behind those that have secured borrowings or lendings at a particular company. Those would be, for example, our loans or other bonds or other fixed income type of arrangements. And stocks have a limited liability, which means that most shareholders can only lose the extent of their original investment. So what I've tried to do here is also give you a sense of the classes of common stocks. Essentially, the common stocks that I think everybody is familiar with are the ones that essentially provide for ownership of a company or general ownership of a company by the exchange, which I've identified, I think, in clause A here. The biggest reason for issuing multiple shares of common stock is to allow for the assignment of voting rights. Now, there are two classes, or there can be multiple classes of common shares. One class of share that is not as common is those that are owned by the original founders or the senior management of a company. They tend to sometimes have what is called a supernormal or super voting right class of share, which essentially gives them a little bit more power, a little bit more voting rights as opposed to the other common shares that may be more publicly available. This essentially affords them the ability to greater control the outcome of a particular firm. So, for example, it isn't too commonplace in our region, but essentially some tech-oriented stocks, Facebook, Apple, Google, where they're senior executives or major principals still run or have control of the company, they have still, despite there being a plethora or a large mass of securities in the marketplace, they still have the ability to control the affairs of the company through these super voting class of shares. Beyond these class of shares, for example, there are other classes of shares, and you can have as many classes of shares as you wish. But essentially, the common point is to understand that there is a class of shares that is like the trading on exchange that is not the only class of shares or may not have the most voting power with respect to the affairs of a company. And then now onto preferred stocks or preferred shares. Preferred shares essentially have a bit hybrid in structure. So they have some features of both equity and debt. They are, however, it's listed on the equity portion of the balance sheet. With respect to the particular preference shares, they don't confer voting power upon its holders. There isn't a contractual obligation to pay dividends, only a promise to pay dividends at some point in time. So preference shares tend to be cumulative in nature, which essentially means that if you don't get paid this year, then the dividends that you would have forgone this year can potentially be paid in the following year. So that's essentially the feature of it being cumulative. The stock payments are treated as dividends and not income. So, and that's why they still resemble stocks rather than bonds. They are not tax deductible expenses. Preference shareholders tend to be senior to the common shareholders, but subordinated to bondholders, which means that they essentially, from a ranking perspective, they have rights over and above those of the common shareholders. So they will essentially get assets or get income in the sense of a liquidation should a company fall under hard times, but they will rank subordinate to bondholders. And sometimes the issuers of preferred shares use this as a mechanism to avoid dilution of the equity of the firm. So they don't want essentially to give up ownership of the firm to anyone, and this class of share affords them that ability. I probably want to pause here and ask if anybody has any questions or if they would prefer me to either slow down, speed up, just to get some initial reaction as to how you guys are feeling about it.
I had a question.
Sure.
Under the features of equity capital, like number 7, the liability of equity shareholders is limited to the extent of their investment. You mentioned that if you buy the share at the stock at $10, their liability, basically, they would sell it back at that same price. There's no liability incurred.
Sorry. Let me just make sure if I understand. So your question is, if you buy a share for $10, right? Your question was?
I was just referring to something that you said that there is no liability, you don't incur any liability, that whatever price you buy the share at is what it can be sold at.
No. Sorry.
Misunderstand.
Sorry, to clarify. So stocks have a limited liability, which is, I think, at the point at point F. So the limited liability associated with the stock is if you've spent $10 on a particular stock by way of purchase, then the most that you can lose is that $10.
Understood.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Does that clarify?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Okay, all right. Let me just go back to where we were previously, which is, I think, American deposit. So another form of equity instrument that is not as common in our region is depository receipts or American depository receipts. And essentially, American deposit receipts came about as a means by which American investors or American persons wanted to acquire shares in foreign companies in a move toward diversification. So these depository receipts essentially were shares of foreign companies were put into banks in a bit of a trust structure to represent ownership in that foreign company. And then the US bank that held those particular shares in that trust would have issued certificates or receipts to shareholders. So the foreign shares were locked away in a bit of a black box, if you want to call it that. They were held on deposit. And against those shares, which were not traded, these depository receipts were made available. The advantage of that is that these US investors would have contributed or invested in US dollars in international markets. and dividend payments sort of come back to these American shareholders in US dollars. So the advantage there for US investors is that they got diversification. However, they didn't take the currency risk associated with investing overseas. And this was fairly popular back in the, I think, the 80s and the 90s. It's not as popular these days, but it is just a form of an equity instrument that I wanted to share with you guys. Moving along, wanted to talk a little bit about equity valuation. So equity valuations, there are a number of methodologies that exist. One that I think that everybody would be familiar with is the discounted cash flow model, dividend discount modeling. And it's a model that's based on the present or discounted value of future cash flows. So we discount cash flows that occur into the future, which are essentially dividend payments. We discount those back to the present to get a sense of what the value of a particular company is. But there are other relative valuation approaches that can be used. Some of them are essentially based on the premise of comparing the price of an asset to the market value of similar assets. All right. So just to kind of get into a little bit more, and I think you should be kind of familiar with this, is that to determine an asset value, in today's perspective, we would look at the future cash flows and discount or reduce that value back to the present point in time. And so this essentially is premised on the concept of time value of money. What's the value of money today relative to in the future? So a dollar today tends to be worth more than a dollar into the future. So we essentially would look at discounted cash flows to get a sense of what the value of a particular company is. This should be a formula that everybody is pretty much familiar with. Time value of money essentially is the discounting is the inverse of compounding. The simple formula is to discount, we essentially take the interest rate plus one and divide it, then take it to the power of the number of periods involved. And compounding essentially is the inverse of that. This essentially is the formula with respect to dividend discount modeling. We will take the summation of all the cash flows over time and discount it by their required rate of return for each particular period. And for each cash flow, we would summarize all of that to get the value of a particular stock today. And I trust everybody would have seen particular examples or done examples of these kinds of numbers already. So essentially, to give you a sense, when you buy a stock, when you take ownership of a stock, you essentially get two particular types of cash flow. Dividends through the life of the holding period, which essentially is your annual streams of payments, either twice a year, quarterly, per year, based on the ownership or the decisions of management of that particular company. But there also the secondary cash flow, which is the expected price at the end of the particular holding period, which essentially is the price at which we would sell that particular stock back over time. When the company generates profit, it has a couple of options. It can pay dividends to shareholders, and this may be in the form of cash payments or additional shares. Or it may decide not to pay dividends at all and reinvest these dollars back into the business for future growth. So, like I said, dividends can either be via cash or stock. And payments are based on the number of shares held by a particular individual. The cash dividends, as you would appreciate, are the dollars that have been received. So, for example, if a company has a cash dividend of $10 per share, you own 1,500 shares, then the simple answer is that you get 15,000 in dividends. However, there's the other example that if you want to make a stock dividend payment, then a company has decided to issue a stock dividend of 5%. If you own 1,500 shares, then the number of shares that you receive is 5% of those 1,500 shares owned, which would be 75 extra shares. So why would companies choose not to pay dividends? As I would have mentioned before, if companies are growing fairly rapidly, then there is always a dilemma or trade-off between paying out money to shareholders, which is an escape of cash from the company, versus retaining that cash to fund or essentially grow the company going forward. So the company that's experiencing financial strain as well, if revenues are declining, may make the decision to defer dividend payments to some small amount or none at all. Or if the company has a particular number of projects or investments coming up, then it may decide to defer or deny these payments so that it has enough cash to do these particular things. I think we'd all appreciate that some of the tech companies as well don't pay significant dividends because they're still in a fairly particular growth phase of the company. And those would be Google, Facebook, and Amazon. One famous example of a company that does have a lot of cash and recently, in the last couple of years, that would have paid a dividend, I think is either Apple or Microsoft. Microsoft and Apple do have, I think it's Microsoft, sorry. Microsoft has a significant war chest of cash where it goes in and spends on a particular number of technologies. I think at one point in time, they didn't see a lot of opportunity for growth, so they decided to send some of that money back to its shareholders. But traditionally, other firms, other normal firms, or depending on the industry, will remit dividends consistently over time back to shareholders. So the dividend discount model here, again, it resembles the formula that we represented before. We essentially have dividends over a period of successive periods, which is the D with the subscript D. So these dividends over time essentially added to the terminal price, which is your ending price at the end of a particular period, will essentially give you a particular value of stock discounted by the required rate of return. What's important here is the required rate of return of the particular cash flow is discounted for its specific period. So the R in time period one is different from the R in time period two and successive time periods. So what we should do is we should be discounting each particular cash flow of dividends and future terminal price by its own individual discount rate to get the true value of the particular stock. And a couple inputs into the dividend discount model that we would need to know. The two basic inputs would be the growth rate of the expected dividend and the required rate of return. The expected growth rate of the dividend is the percentage growth rate of the stock dividend projected to increase over a period of time. And the required rate of return, as I would have mentioned, is the minimum return earned on each investment that will encourage investors to purchase it. So what I've done here as well is essentially gone through the model in some fair detail. But sorry, let me ask one question here. Would this presentation be available to you guys after we close off today?
Yes, it would be.
It will be, okay. So I don't want to spend too much time going through necessarily the mechanics of the particular model because it's just fairly computational in approach. So as long as we understand the formula, then I think it's just to make sure that we get going through the examples of how to calculate this. But suffice it to say, what I'd say is computing the dividend growth rate essentially is the proportion of earnings that are retained by the company, which is the retention rate. And then you're taking that retention rate and multiplying it by the return of the particular return on equity to get the growth rate of the dividend over time. So again, this is just essentially how it's calculated. for your additional information. And here I'm just basically giving you an example of how to calculate it. So essentially we have the return on equity, essentially is net income for the particular period divided by your asset manager liabilities. The return on equity is essentially 21%. Dividend payout essentially is the dividend paid divided by your net income. That gives you 23.75. So your sustainable growth rate essentially is 1 minus the dividend payout ratio, which is retention ratio, times the return on equity to give you a sustainable growth rate of 16.4%. So the math is fairly simple in nature. To give you a sense of what dividend yield is, I think we can read it, but dividend yield essentially is the annual dividend divided by the price per share. It's a fairly easy calculation. So what I've tried to do here is just give you a working example that you can follow. So I'll let you guys do this at your own particular speed after the presentation is finished. Just so that we make sure that we stay on time. Capital asset pricing model. As again, I think we're familiar with this, but just to kind of reiterate, CAPM essentially is a measure of the return, rate of return the investor receives on a particular stock. It is also the required rate of return or the cost of equity. And the CAPM model essentially is the expected rate of return is equal to the risk-free rate times plus the beta of an asset multiplied by the expected return on a market portfolio minus that risk-free rate. So the expected rate of return minus the risk-free rate essentially is known as the market risk premium, or a measure of the excess return that is required above the risk-free rate. So again, here's an example. We have a particular company who basically has a beta of 1.3. 10-year government yield is 12%, and this is a barometer or a proxy for a risk-free rate, assuming that the government is risk-free. The expected market return is 8%, and what's the required return for the particular stock? So our market risk premium is this 12% minus this 8%, which is 4%, times the 1.3 times beta, plus the 12%, which is the original risk-free rate, and that gives you a 70% rate of return that the investor will require to invest in company A. So the math is fairly simple in that regard. Again, this is an example that just goes through the iteration of how to calculate the rate of return, starting with your growth rate and then coming through your CAPM model. Another model or another approach is the Gordon growth discount model. And the Gordon growth discount model essentially is where dividends are assumed to grow at a constant rate into perpetuity. And the model essentially is used when certain conditions exist. The firm is in a particular state of its life cycle, which is a mature industry. There's an existing stable capital structure. Essentially, there is a well-defined mix of debt and equity in the firm's capital structure. And there is stable earnings and dividend payout ratios over a particular period of time. So this is not essentially for quickly growing or rapidly growing companies. Essentially, this would be for fairly stable and static companies that exist within a particular market. Again, here we have a simple model of how to value a stock with a company that is mature, has a particular stable capital structure, and essentially stable growth in dividends over time. So I'll leave you to do that in your own time and speed. So essentially, the application of intrinsic value under the Gordon growth model. This true worth is compared against the current market price, which essentially is how much our investors are willing to pay for a particular stock. And this approach will determine whether the stock is overvalued or undervalued. So if you have a particular stock whose intrinsic value or true worth is less than the current market price, then the current market price that's available or viewable in the marketplace is overvalued relative to that particular company. So you'd essentially not want to hold stocks that would tend to be overvalued because they're likely to get correction, and therefore this is not worth having. However, the opposite is true. If you have a particular stock whose intrinsic or true value is greater than the current market price, then that stock is undervalued and would make sense acquiring further positions in so that you can capture that value as that correction takes place over time, assuming that the markets are efficient. So here's an example of where we try to show that a particular stock is undervalued. So we do the computation, and relative to its current price, the intrinsic value is north of the current price. And then this $16.25 would be a representation of how undervalued this particular stock is relative to its current price. There are some relative valuation models that I think we'd be familiar with. The most common example of that is price-to-earnings ratio. And price-to-earnings ratio essentially is the market price per share divided by the earnings per share. Essentially, it is the price can be the current price or average price of a particular stock for a period of time, usually a year. And the earnings per share can be the most recent financial year or trailing 12 months or forecasted earnings per share number. Again, I've given you a small example here of how to calculate the price earnings ratio of Amazon, assuming that we have certain particular information, that being its earnings per share and its market price per share. So again, the math is fairly logical in that regard. So what I've tried to do here is I feel this also just in the interest of time, but essentially, if you didn't have the two rightmost columns, you could essentially take the market price, net income, and the outstanding shares, and work out the earnings per share, which essentially is the net income divided by the outstanding shares of the firm, to get the earnings per share value. And then with the market price and the earnings per share, you essentially would take the market price divided by the earnings per share to get the PE, or the price earnings ratio. So again, a fairly easy example of how to calculate earnings per share as well as price earnings ratio. So application of PE multiples. So to compare companies' price earnings to average peer in the industry is a way to determine if the stock is overvalued or undervalued. So if we have, for example, an industry PE, which is greater than a company-specific PE, then that company's price-earnings ratio relative to the industry is undervalued and would represent a buying opportunity or an opportunity to acquire those particular shares. However, if the converse was true, where the price-earnings ratio of a particular company was in excess of the industry PE, then that would be an opportunity to sell or lighten your position because that particular stock would be seen as being overvalued. And again, I've given you an example here to show that if you sort of ignore the rightmost column, if you had the PEs for these four companies and you calculated the average PE, then what you could do is you can compare each of these PE ratios for these firms relative to this price earnings ratio to come up with an assessment of whether the stock is overvalued or undervalued. And essentially, that is going to be pretty much the majority of what I wanted to kind of say under fixed income instruments. Let me just check one thing here. Under equities. So I pretty much get into fixed income instruments as of now. What I'd like to do is, and I think that people pretty much understand what savings accounts and certificates of deposit. And savings accounts and CDs are essentially your most basic form of a fixed income instrument. They are traditional banking products that I think everybody would have or would be familiar with. Essentially, it is the low risk in nature. I understand that savings accounts in the Eastern Caribbean may not have deposit insurance attached to them, but around the world and in other parts of the Caribbean region, there is deposit insurance attached to savings accounts, which essentially says that if the bank goes under for any reason whatsoever, there is an amount of money that can be recovered through deposit insurance to depositors. In Trinidad, I think that amount is maybe $125,000. And around the world, there are different varying amounts that are protected by your legislation. The basic returns associated with savings accounts are fairly low when compared to other alternative instruments, simply because of the low risk nature associated with savings accounts. With certificates of deposit, there is the potential that the interest rates associated with certificates of deposit are a little bit higher, simply because certificates of deposits are not immediately available in the same manner in which savings accounts are available. So they tend to not be as liquid. They are liquid, but not as liquid as savings accounts. And there is a minimum deposit size associated with them. And because you're willing to give up your access to certificates of deposit, certificates of deposits by banks are usually available in fairly standard denominations, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, potentially 2 years. And because you go out in time, based on time value of money, you'd be willing to accept a higher rate of return for your ability to forego that access to those funds immediately. So presumably and rationally, the 1 year interest rate on a CD should always be higher than the 3 or 6 month rate on a CD. Other types of fixed income instruments, which is pretty much what I think we'd all be familiar with, is treasury securities, and these can be treasury bills, treasury notes, treasury bonds issued by a central bank on behalf of a particular government or sovereign country. These treasury securities tend to be very liquid as well, and the within a particular country, it's best example of zero credit risk associated with an instrument. So treasury bills or treasury securities tend to be widely available, very liquid, easily sold and transferable between parties, and are backed by the full faith and credit of a particular government. So that's why essentially they're free of risk and essentially would not have the most attractive interest rate associated with them. Government agency securities, however, are obligations of the government. They're unlikely to default. They tend not to be as liquid as treasury securities. And because of that little bit extra level of illiquidity, there is an opportunity to earn a higher yield on government agency securities than treasury securities. So example of government agency securities that I think will exist in the Eastern Caribbean region. Let me think about one instance where there's a government agency security. Let me give you a Trinidad example. We have in Trinidad, for example, a number of statutory organizations, the Water Authority, the Electricity Company. They have issued bonds and securities over time. The Water Authority and the Electricity Distribution Company are government owned by statutory law. And because of that, they are owned 100% by the government of Trinidad and Tobago. So these entities are able to borrow funds from the capital markets locally on the basis that the government continues to own them outright. And as a result of that, essentially resemble or carry a strong correlation to the government payment risk. These bonds may sometimes be associated with a government guarantee, not always, but they sometimes will be. They will not be direct obligations of government, but they essentially they will carry the same ability to repay, such as government. Corporate securities, essentially, is another class of debt being offered. Corporate securities are issued by industrial companies, banks, conglomerates, to invest in anything that and everything that they would like to do, from working capital, which is its shorter term side, to also investing in plants and equipment or any other expansionary activities that the firm may be thinking of. Corporate securities do have credit risk attached to them with respect to the issuance of these bonds, because there is a possibility that they may default at some point in time. Some companies are more at risk of defaulting than others, but essentially all corporate securities do have the potential that they can default. There are ways to mitigate some of the default risk associated with corporate securities. What you can do essentially is that you can issue secured bonds, which essentially are bonds that are backed by the assets of a particular firm or some other collateral that is available to the investors in the event that there is a particular bankruptcy. What we can also do is we can also issue unsecured bonds as well. And unsecured bonds, by the very definition, is where there is no collateral associated with those particular borrowings of a corporate entity. And then we can also issue subordinated bonds, which essentially are bonds that have a lower priority claim on the firm's assets, even in the event of bankruptcy. And what you'd find is, as you go through the various levels of secured borrowings or secured bonds straight through subordinated, then they would carry their own respective interest rates. So the secured bonds would have a lower rate of interest than subordinated bonds. Bonds also have an indenture attached to them, or trust deed, and the trust deed essentially is a recital of a number of clauses that binds or bonds the company to perform particular activities associated with that financing. So it's the obligations of the issuer that must be carried out in the performance or in the requirement or need to get this funding. So in the particular bond indenture or trust deed, you have particular features that the company must repay its obligations on particular dates and times. There may be certain assets associated with the borrowing. There may be particular financial covenants or conditions to be met. There may be certain leverage ratios or other financial ratios that are inherent in the documentation. What happens in the event of a bankruptcy? When can meetings be called to discuss particular activities associated with the firm? Just any number of conditions and conditionalities that a firm may be required to undertake in the requirement or the performance of getting financing. And then in their international bonds as well. So international bonds, as the name does suggest, is essentially borrowing in the international markets or borrowing abroad. And essentially, there are many instances where investors do buy bonds from foreign issuers. I think we may be familiar with Eurobonds. And Eurobonds essentially are bonds that are denominated in a particular currency other than the home country in which it is issued. So some example of Eurobonds in our part of the world, the government of Barbados has issued Eurobonds, which is essentially, they will have gone to the international capital markets and raised US dollars outside of Barbados for the use of the government of Barbados and the people of Barbados. Other countries will have done it. Jamaica, Trinidad and Tobago, I believe Grenada has done it as well. The Bahamas have done it as well. So these companies are going to the international environment through the assistance of a large US bank and it's few foreign securities that are basically bought by international investors, usually in markets in London, New York, San Francisco, Asia, and further afield. So some examples of Eurobonds, a Yankee bond essentially is a US dollar denominated bond sold outside of the US. Samurai bond essentially is a yen denominated bond that's sold outside of Japan. I wanted to talk a little bit about primary markets to just give you a sense of the difference between primary markets and secondary markets. Primary markets, so primary markets essentially is an avenue or is a place where firms are able to raise capital through the sale of new securities or the floating of new securities. And primary markets can be divided into two aspects, either equity markets or debt capital markets. And within those two types of markets, you can have two types of primary market issuances or issues. You can have public offerings and you can have private placements. So what is a public offering? A public offering is one where there's an issue of either stocks or bonds that is sold for the first time to the investing public. So to give you an example of bonds that would, or fixed income securities that would have been recently issued in the primary market, I think the ECSM, through its issuing calendar, will issue through the exchange over a period of time, treasury securities, securities from, I think it's ECHMB, which is the Caribbean Home Mortgage Organization. Who else would issue on the ECSM? I can't think of any others right now. Those are the two names that come to particular, but all the sovereign nations within the EC region, St. Kitts, St. Lucia, Dominica, Antigua, I think those are the four main ones, essentially would, over time, issue these securities for the first time across the exchange to market participants. Private placements are a little bit different. Private placements are the same issue of stocks and bonds, but are sold to fewer investors or high net worth investors. These investors tend to hold the maturity and they're not traded over an exchange. So essentially, in Trinidad, for example, we tend to have a very vibrant primary market for public offerings, as well as a very vibrant private placement market. That's driven by high net worth investors, pension plans, insurance companies, trusts, mutual funds, the national security system, where they would essentially have appetite to hold a number of bonds over time as their cash needs would allow for them to do. And they tend not to sell, and they have this buy and hold nature with respect to their investment. So that's one example of primary markets on the debt side, where you have private placement. However, debt and equity public offerings are typically invested, typically marketed by investment bankers called underwriters. So it doesn't exist too much in the Eastern Caribbean region, but in Trinidad, for example, you have a number of banks, local as well as international, that would assist these companies in raising funds or through debt instruments or equity instruments to essentially fund their activities. And some of those banks would be, for example, Citibank, the bank that I work for, First Citizens, Scotiabank, Republic Bank, First Caribbean. All these banks have the ability or have these skills within their human resource capability to assist companies in raising debt and or equity via the public markets. Just to kind of give you a little bit more information as to what happened with respect to these deals, essentially you can't have more than one underwriter or one lead banker that's working on a transaction. They tend to perform or work within an underwriting syndicate where both parties or both banks or any number of banks work together to achieve the funding requirements of the borrower. The primary banker for raising the capital is known as the lead underwriter, and he would coordinate all the activities of the other underwriting partners or underwriting syndicate members. In order to sell these securities to the public, these securities are usually registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, or in our part today with the ECSRC in St. Kitts, or in Trinidad, the Trinidad Securities and Exchange Commission. These securities will be registered and will be covered by what is known as a preliminary prospectus, or in U.S. parlance, a red herring document. And essentially, it's essentially a document that itemizes all of the information, all of the risks, all of the financial statements, and anything with respect to the company that will be required for the public to know in the furtherance or in the ability to buy these securities. So when the statement is finalized and approved by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the document moves from being a red herring document to something that is approved by the regulator, which is then called a prospectus. And at this point in time, with the approval of the prospectus, the securities are usually priced and then offered to the market for purchase. So on the public offering side, which is the private placement side, what you have is essentially an issuing company that then resells securities to the marketplace. And this is done, again, via underwriters. The underwriter or the syndicate members of the underwriting pool would purchase these securities at an offering price that is less than what is available in the marketplace. And the difference between that particular price and the offer price to the market is essentially the spread that the underwriter or the underwriting party would earn. And this process essentially is called a firm commitment on underwriting. An underwriting essentially is the mechanism by which a bank will say, I will buy these securities from the issuer, because I have the faith or the distinct impression that when I do sell these securities back to the market, I can make a profit on it. And by doing that, the underwriter assumes all of the risks associated with the securities. In the case that if they are not sold, then that is the loss that the underwriter would face. So not all banks want to put their balance sheet at risk by offering a firm commitment or an underwriting position. So what tends to happen is that the bankers or the underwriters to the transaction will essentially instead offer what is called a best efforts agreement. And the best efforts agreement is, as the name implies, it will provide its best efforts to help the firm sell the securities, but it doesn't necessarily purchase the securities themselves. So if there's an instance where the securities are not sold, then there is no risk to the underwriter, and the issuing firm essentially gets only what has been raised through the best efforts arrangement in the marketplace. So the underwriter does not bear the risk of being unable to sell securities and only acts as an intermediary between the firm and the public that's buying the securities. By way of private placements, as I would have mentioned before, the private placement offerings are sold by the firm directly to a smaller group of investors and individuals, usually sophisticated investors. And in our part, sophisticated investors means investors that have some sort of investment acumen, or they have a particular net worth or available cash with which to invest in particular instruments. Private placements in terms of cost tends to be cheaper than public offerings because there isn't the extensive and costly registration process that usually is tied to a public offering. When you're doing a public offering, you're engaging not just bankers or underwriters, but you're engaging external counsel, marketing personnel. You're also including accountants to audit statements. There's in fact an entire large team that is associated with a public offering that you may not necessarily find with all private placements. So it tends to be cheaper to issue securities under private placement offering than a public offering. And by that very nature, private placements are not available to the general public and are left suited to very large offerings. So there is, it tends to be a natural demarcation in terms of what size of deal can be sold to a private placement and what type of deal can be sold to by a public offering. If you have a very well-defined capital market, as we do in Trinidad, what you tend to find is that you have very large institutional investors, as you do, for example, in the Eastern Caribbean region. You have a very large investor in your respective country's national insurance scheme or national insurance board. They tend to be one of the largest investors, and they would essentially buy any number of transactions that are available. But alongside the national insurance or social security system, what you also have available in terms of large investors is pension plans, insurance companies, mutual funds. Sometimes some companies or conglomerates also invest as well. But the private placement market tends not to be a market where the general individual or retail public can buy securities from. Private placements, and by that very nature, do not trade on secondary markets such as security exchanges. So they tend to be limited to being available once and once only at the primary market stage. And that these investors who have a buy and hold mentality associated with them will essentially hold these instruments over time, and they will never come back into the light of day in terms of trading in the public market. And that by that very nature, because they're bought and held by these large entities, they tend to be very illiquid, or more illiquid than public offerings. Again, you have primary debt capital markets and primary equity capital markets. So primary debt capital markets, or the bond market, is comprised of longer-term instruments or longer-term debt instruments, commonly referred to as the fixed income market, because most of them promise a fixed income stream over a period of time. And we'll be familiar with various types of fixed income markets. Those would be our treasury markets, our corporate bond markets, our international bond markets, or mortgage-backed security markets, or agency markets, or any sort of fixed income market that would exist in the Caribbean region or further afield in the international environment. We also have primary equity capital markets. Again, equity capital markets would account for the issuance of new securities. New stock issuances usually fall into two groups: initial public offerings, or what are called additional public offerings, which is a second wave of a company issuing shares in the marketplace. Initial public offerings involve the sale, as you probably would appreciate, involve the sale of common stock by a firm to the public for the first time. A sealed issue or additional public offering would be a sale of shares to the public on a secondary occasion. At the first time, there is no existing public market for the stock, so there is essentially a means by which, or then there's essentially a need to essentially promote or market these securities in the market. Seasoned issues or additional public offerings, as I would have mentioned, essentially is an offer of new shares by a firm that already has outstanding shares in the market. And as I would have mentioned, a secondary capital market is one where the sale or purchase of securities has taken place amongst investors. The secondary markets allow for trading of outstanding issues, that is either stocks or bonds that have already been sold to the public, and can be traded to current or potentially new investors. and these secondary market trading opportunities would likely take place over an exchange. The proceeds of the sale of these securities in the secondary market do not go to the issuer, but rather to the current owner of the stock. So in an initial public offering, the company that offering the securities receives that cash from the investing public. But via the secondary markets, the proceeds from any transfer of securities goes to the previous holder of those securities and not back to the company that would have originally issued those securities. Why are secondary markets important? They're particularly important because they provide liquidity to existing securities holders who may wish to sell. If there was no available secondary market, investors may hesitate in terms of purchasing securities initially because there may not be a mechanism to sell. What the secondary markets also allow to happen is there's an opportunity for price discovery. So price discovery essentially will give a basis or provide some sense of where new issuance of stocks and bonds that have been sold in the primary markets can essentially trade in the secondary markets, depending on price and yield. So what you really want to do is, wherever possible in every country, you want to basically have a vibrant secondary market, because it not only provides for trading opportunities amongst participants in that market, but also serve as a guide to when new securities could be potentially issued as we go forward. So they're very, very important. To give you a sense of equity markets, or equity secondary markets that are available, there are three segments of equity markets, those being national exchanges or national stock exchanges, regional stock exchanges, or over-the-counter markets. We would have a fair sense of the national stock exchanges. Those would be the highest standard or most stringent listing requirements of exchanges that exist in any particular country or around the world, and would be considered the most prestigious. So, for example, national stock exchanges would be the New York Stock Exchange or the American Stock Exchange or the London Stock Exchange, or essentially any one of the traditional stock exchanges that exist in any of the larger countries around the world. In our part of the world, we tend to only have one stock exchange, which essentially would be a national stock exchange. So, for example, in the EC region, we would have the Eastern Caribbean Securities Market. In Barbados, we would have the Barbados Stock Exchange. Jamaica has its own stock exchange, as well as Trinidad. We also have regional stock exchanges as well. They're not as prestigious. They tend to be a little bit more localized than national stock exchanges. The listing requirements are not as hard or onerous as the national stock exchanges, but their focus may be more geographic in nature rather than national in scope and scale. So some of these examples would be Boston Stock Exchange or the Pacific Exchange that exists. Some regional stock exchange list firms that are also listed on national stock exchanges. Again, this affords the opportunity for wider trading of a particular stock. We also have, for example, just to give you a sense of types of markets, we have equity bull markets and we have bear markets. I think you're familiar with what a bull market is. Essentially, a bull market is a market where a group of securities which prices are rising or expected to rise over a period of time. Essentially, bull markets are associated with investor confidence or buoyancy or optimism that things will get stronger in the market as we go forward. Conversely, a bear market is the opposite. It essentially is a barometer for pessimism or negative sentiment or lack of investor confidence that would suggest that as we go forward, there may be losses associated with a particular market. So bull markets essentially invite investors to rush in and participate in the buoyancy or the upward movement in the market. And bear markets essentially lead to investors wanting to retreat from the markets. to give you a sense of secondary debt markets. Again, secondary debt markets, which are pretty much what we would understand in our part of the world. There's a secondary government market. That essentially is where government or treasury instruments are traded by bond dealers. And these dealers are usually found in our larger banks, broker-dealer houses, who make markets for these instruments. We also have the corporate bond market, as I would have mentioned previously, another example of a secondary debt market. And these bonds are essentially traded over the counter by dealers who buy and sell these securities from their own accounts. Again, the corporate bond market players would be the large investment banks that underwrite these securities, where you can go to these same investment banks and potentially buy securities, or they will make markets for these securities over time. Corporate bonds tend to be less actively traded than government bonds, so they tend not to have a fairly wide inventory of issues available. So they will hold a limited supply over time, just for the sake of their clients. But what tends to happen is that those that wish to trade, they will act more like brokers, and they essentially will bring other players or other holders of securities, and they will essentially intermediate between bid and ask spreads to orchestrate a trade. So again, government markets tend to be fairly more liquid than corporate bond markets. And corporate bond markets do have some investment or have some inventory of investments available, but likely less so than government bond markets. Just want to get a little, let me pause here, guys, and see how you guys are going, how you guys are feeling. Any questions, any concerns so far?
Thanks, Stu. Hi.
Hi.
Any example of over-the-counter market?
Over-the-counter market. So example of the over-the-counter market is, in Trinidad, this is the example I could probably give you. So most of the markets in the region tend to be predominantly fixed income instrument markets. So sometimes investors do want to sell positions, and they will essentially approach some brokerage houses. So for example, I work for a company where they essentially would intermediate and sell securities between buyers and sellers over time. So they tend to be informal and more custom in nature, driven by whoever wants to buy an instrument versus sell an instrument. The US market does have over-the-counter markets or over-the-counter selling. I can't think of anyone right now, but let me see if I can get a name for you overnight and share that with you tomorrow.
Okay, no problem.
Yeah?
Yeah, so it's not something that's predominant in the region.
Yeah, it's not very predominant. Any other questions? Okay. So switching gears a little bit, so one of the issues, one of the topics that was requested to be covered was corporate governance. And to give you a sense of corporate governance essentially is a body of rules, practices, and processes that a firm is either directed or controlled by. So it provides guidance as to what a firm should do in terms of the management of its affairs. It requires the balancing of interests between a company's stakeholders or shareholders and the management of that particular company alongside its customers, suppliers, financiers, government, and its community. So what you find happening is that each of these players within a particular firm have their own vested interests. And sometimes those vested interests either work together or work against one another. And what has happened over time is that there's been the evolution of corporate governance to guide how each of these players get their own space and time as a firm begins to go through what it needs to go through in terms of its going concern nature. So corporate governance is an essential ingredient that exists in pretty much all firms, or definitely all of the large firms in all parts of the world, to guide and provide a framework for attaining the company's objectives. And essentially guides and shapes management. It informs its action plans. It essentially involves or directs its internal controls and guides its performance measurement as well as its corporate disclosure to the public as well as regulators. So corporate governance is an essential feature of many, if not all, firms to guide how it acts and behaves over time. So what is good corporate governance and bad corporate governance? So good corporate governance essentially creates a transparent set of rules and controls that shareholders, directors, and officers have an incentive to adhere to. So all companies would like to strive for a high level of corporate governance, but not all attain it. So it's always, and it's a journey, it's a journey rather than a destination. You can always improve in your corporate governance, but you should never rest on the laurels of your corporate governance model. So for most shareholders, it's not just important to be profitable, but it's also important to represent or reflect good corporate citizenship through its environmental awareness or its ethical behavior or its good practices. So what you find has developed over time, pretty much in the last couple of decades, is it hasn't been that firms should only pursue profit as a motive. There has been a strong sense of giving back to society through its corporate responsibility or corporate social responsibility program, where it will assist in the community in which it resides to make that particular city, town, or country a better place. And essentially that mantra or ethos is enshrined within a company's corporate governance methodology or model. So conversely, what does bad corporate governance do? Well, it casts a doubt on a company's reliability, its integrity, its strength, and its obligation. And essentially can impair a firm's financial health. Bad corporate governance can lead to scandals and other illegal or illicit activities. So firms always try to demonstrate good corporate governance. And essentially, I don't think any of us would want to work for firms that demonstrate bad corporate governance versus good corporate governance. And there have been a number of studies over time that would suggest that firms that do exhibit good corporate governance empirically do perform better than firms that have bad corporate governance. And it tends to allow for firms or persons that work within those firms to be acting in concert to achieve the broad objectives of the firm. So to give you a little more sense of what is required or what is covered under corporate governance, a good corporate governance suggests or should suggest that there be some independence among the members of the board of directors. A key attribute of the board of directors and their independence is that they should be made up of a majority of outside or independent directors. What we have seen in our part of the world is that there have been a number of companies that have been family-owned or founder-owned that essentially you have a strong principal, and as those companies have grown over time, the management level of the company has gone on to the board. So the management of the firm has been leading the strategic direction or the corporate governance of the firm. And within the last decade or two, that's changed significantly, where you now invite outside persons or non-executive persons to be part of the cadre of independent directors. So a board with the majority of insiders often viewed as being stacked or counter to good corporate governance, particularly where the CEO of a company is also the chairman of its board. So the benefit of having an outsider is that the person would have never worked at the company, is not involved with the employees of the companies, doesn't have any significant supplier contracts, or is tied to the company in a particular way, would not have provided services to the company by way of accountants, lawyers, investment banking, consulting. These persons would be independent and free of thought to provide what they think is the best standard for the operating of this particular company. So the larger the number of outside directorships that you have, the better your corporate governance model should or could be. It makes the board a little bit more independent than another one and allows for a high level of corporate governance exhibited to shareholders. Particularly if you have this CEO potentially being separated from the chairman of the board. So it shows a difference of thought, and you potentially can get the best minds between the CEO and the chair of the board coming together if they are separate persons. So what you tend to find happening now is that the chairman of the board can be or is usually seen or welcome to be an outsider who can drive that independence of sorts at the level of the board. And through the independence of directorships, what we try to do is we try to break up any potential for interlocking directorships. What you find happening in today's world is that you have very large single primary legal entities forming a bit of a holding company structure. If you think about banks in the region, banks aren't just traditional banks anymore. They are traditional banks by way of our traditional savings and loan products, but they sometimes have an asset management firm. They sometimes have a merchant bank. They sometimes have a trust company or securities company or brokerage company. So banks over time have become less of single scale and scope entities and more holding company structures. And each one of these companies within that holding company structure is a legal entity. And what happens is at the holding company level, you tend to get, as I would have mentioned before, the management of those individual firms now being elevated to sit on the holding company board structure. So what you find happening is that you have directors of more than one company sitting and intermingling and interlocking with other directors. And therefore what happens is that you tend to have challenges where you have moral hazard situations developing. And by moral hazard developing, what I mean is that you have challenges of thought or the inability to essentially separate thought and be objective occurring. So sometimes, even though interlocking directorships can make for effective deterrent to unwarranted corporate advances, which is to stave off acquisitions or hostile takeovers by a particular firm, it does raise questions surrounding corporate governance. And so what you want to do is try to remove or take away these interlocking directorships or these interlocking relationships to essentially bring corporate governance back to the fold. So academics and corporate leaders alike are trying and always exploring ways in which you can balance the benefits against the drawbacks of having good corporate governance practices and structures. Companies, whether it be corporate finance or otherwise, are always affected by what are called agency problems. And agency problems usually refer to the conflicts of interest that are inherent within companies' management and companies' stockholders. What you find is that the manager, who is acting as an agent of the shareholder in terms of managing the firm, is supposed to, by theory, make the decisions that are best for shareholders, which is profit maximization. The challenge with that is that his incentive is to make as much money as possible for himself as well. So what you find happening is that the company may be taking on significant levels of risk in the furtherance of achieving this profitability. So what you find happening is that the agency problem arises due to an issue with incentives and the presence of discretion by management in terms of its task completion. Management can be motivated to act in a particular manner, which may be detrimental to shareholders. If it sees an incentive in a particular direction. So if a situation arises where to make more money, you would essentially have to break rules or act in a particular way that is not in the best interest of a shareholder, management in the pursuit of profit maximization can or may be minded to break the rules in achieving that. So in an effort to minimize this agency problem, what you try to do is they try to incentivize management to act better in accordance with shareholder interests through performance-based compensation that is directly influenced by the shareholders, as well as the threat of firing or the takeovers. So what you really try to do is you try to manage the management of the firm by still achieving the objectives of the shareholders, but find different forms of compensation where if he achieves all of the metrics that the shareholders require, he gets a bonus or enhanced form of compensation that is back end based on achieving a particular target. To give you a sense of venture capital now. So what is venture capital? Venture capital essentially is the financing that investors would need to provide startup companies with the ability to grow over time. Venture capital really comes from well-off investors, investment banks or financial institutions. It does not just take the form of monetary means, but also can come in the form of technical or managerial expertise. It is very risky for investors who do put up funds, but the achievement of above average returns is usually enough as an incentive for that risk that must be surmounted. So for new companies or ventures that have a limited operating history, venture capitalism is a vibrant and active market to allow for sources of capital to come into particular firms, where those particular firms may not have access to other traditional forms of financing, be it capital markets or banks or other debt instruments that may be available. So what usually happens is that investors that do get into the equity do, however, have a fair say in the direction of the company because they're the ones that are putting their money into the transaction or the company. So venture capitalists or venture capitalism essentially affords you the ability through the provision of your funds to direct how a firm will be shaped and grown over time. And for that contribution, you get to essentially drive how that company looks, smells, and feels as you go forward. So I want to spend a little bit more time talking about fixed income securities in the main. So I think based on the course content that was provided by Alusha and her team, this essentially deals with a significant amount of the risk, as well as how you would price fixed income securities. Again, I want to pause here and ask if there, because this is a natural break in the presentation, if there are any other questions or any other concerns that persons may have that you may want to ask at this point in time. Okay, so in the course content that was provided, there was a request to sort of look at the risk associated with bonds and fixed income instruments. And as you can see here, there are quite a variety of risks associated with bonds, from interest rate risk to event risk. what I've also done here is essentially I've tried to provide a little definition of what each of these various types of risk would involve. Again, I think this is really for nighttime reading, but the ones that I kind of want you to kind of focus on, given that our markets tend to be fixed income or fixed income in nature or fixed income securities in nature, is be mindful of interest rate risks and reinvestment risks. So interest rate risk essentially is, as you would know, if the price of a particular bond would increase over time, then the yield on those securities would fall based on the inverse relationship that exists between the price of a bond and the yield on a particular bond. Also be mindful of reinvestment risk opportunities. So, for example, if you invest in a particular bond and interest rates are rising, then the overall rate of return that you enjoy on that bond is enhanced by having those interim cash flows reinvested at higher prevailing market rates. However, the reverse is true. If you have a bond where interest rates in the market have fallen, then you're likely not to achieve the required rate of return under the instrument because your cash flows are being reinvested at lower interest rates in the marketplace. So be mindful of interest rate risk and reinvestment risk when you're considering investing in securities. Core risk essentially is some bonds have a particular feature that allow the issuer of the bond or the firm that's issuing the bond to call the bond away from the marketplace for a variety of reasons. It may have come into cash flow, or it may want to refinance the bond in a particular market environment, presumably because interest rates are lower and therefore it can lower its cost of borrowing. Call provisions or call risk essentially is to the disadvantage of the investing public. The cash flow pattern of a callable bond is not known with certainty because you don't know when the bond may or may not. So you want to be careful when you're investing in instruments that have call provisions or call options. As I would have mentioned, the borrower has the ability to call the bonds when interest rates would have fallen, which again exposes the investor to reinvestment risk. Because if the bond is not called away ahead of its maturity date, where you're expecting to enjoy a particular rate of interest, then you know, and it's presumably because interest rates have fallen in the marketplace, then you now have to find an alternative investment fairly quickly in a lower interest rate environment to invest those recently maturing funds. So there are challenges associated with that. What you also want to consider as well is that the capital appreciation potential of a bond is reduced because the price of a callable bond may not rise much above the price at which the borrower is willing to call the bond. So what that essentially means is if the bond has a call feature, then as interest rates fall, which means the bond, the price of the bond will rise with the falling interest rate, then the upward movement of that price of the bond is going to be limited or capped. Because as interest rates fall, the expectation is that the issuer will likely call the bonds away from the market. So you're going to be limited in your ability to realize capital appreciation on the particular instrument should this arise. A big thing here is default risk that you'd also want to be concerned with. It's also known as credit risk. This affects, as I would have mentioned before, everybody in the marketplace. Everybody wants to try and stay away from default risk because the default risk is really the concern about the return of principal over time and the unlikely nature that these funds will not come back to the investors that made these investments. In the international markets, there is the there are a number of credit rating agencies that do provide ratings on companies in an attempt to stave off default risk. Those companies you probably would appreciate would be Moody's, Fitch, Dun & Bradstreet, Standard & Poor's, IDCA. But in the region, we also have one example, which is Caricris. It's domiciled in Trinidad. But Caricris is a regional or Caribbean rating agency, which is owned by Standard & Poor's and Crisil out of India. But they do the exact same thing, which is to supply credit ratings on a number of agencies that exist throughout the region, those being corporate as well as government and government agencies. Bonds with default risk tend to trade at a price that is lower when compared to treasury instruments. Again, there are bonds that are associated with default tend to trade at significant discounts, which essentially is a barometer of what is the recoverable value of a particular instrument. So as I would have mentioned before, treasury securities, which tend to be free of default risk, tend to be afforded or be given the higher prices relative to bonds that have credit risk or default risk associated with them. Inflation risk is something you should also be concerned with. Inflation risk is the loss of purchasing power. So if you have a bond that's paying 7% and inflation is 8%, then you really are earning a negative interest rate of 1%. So you really have you have lost purchasing power, or there is no real return rate interest rate on that particular instrument. So always be mindful that when you're investing, to know where the inflation rate of a particular country is, because your investments may be underwater at any particular point in time. Exchange rate risk, exchange rate risk is something you should also be concerned with. And liquidity risk is something you should also be concerned with. I think we're all familiar with liquidity risk. It's something that is a feature of our markets. Instruments tend not to be easily saleable because investors tend not to want to part with these securities. Investors tend to have a buy and hold mentality with respect to the purchase and sale of securities, so they don't tend to come into the marketplace because its securities are not issued in a manner or in the variety and frequency with which most investors would like to. So they usually lose shortage of securities, and because of that shortage, instruments tend to be fairly illiquid. From an exchange risk standpoint, so essentially if you have a non-EC dollar denominated bond that has unknown EC dollar cash flows, then what you have happening is that the EC dollar cash flows are dependent on an exchange rate at a particular point in time in the future. So if you have, for example, an investor who purchases a bond where payments are made in Trinidad and Tobago dollars, and Trinidad and Tobago has a floating exchange rate rather than a fixed exchange rate, unlike the EC region, which has a peg or fixed exchange rate system. If you have a situation where you've purchased a bond with cash flow denominated in Trinidad and Tobago dollars, and the Trinidad and Tobago dollar depreciates relative to the Eastern Caribbean dollar, then what you have happening is that fewer Eastern Caribbean dollars are going to be received, and therefore that exposes you to the currency risk. So you want to be mindful of, if you're investing in instruments that are outside of your natural currency of EC dollars, and probably not US dollars, but any other currency that is available, Trinidad dollars, Barbados dollars, Jamaica dollars, you want to be mindful of the exposure that you may be making yourself open to, which is the exchange rate risk. Other risks that you want to be mindful of are volatility risk, yield curve risk. I will leave you guys to read some of these as well. and then event risk. And event risk can be anything from natural disasters, hurricanes, earthquakes, other climatic conditions, civil war, riots, political factors, as you probably would appreciate these days, things such as the trade wars that exist between the United States and China right now, or other things that may be more localized in terms of takeovers and corporate restructuring. Any of these events can have an effect on market and influence how markets behave one way or another over time. Moving on, I want to kind of get into a bit of, and it's about 50 minutes to go before 4 o'clock, but I want to basically talk a little bit about bond pricing. And so bond pricing is and the relationship between the bond price and its particular yield. A fundamental property with respect to bonds, prices and yields is that there's a bit of an inverse relationship. So as bond prices rise, yields fall, and as bond prices fall, yields rise. And the reason for this is that the price of a bond is essentially, as we have seen before, the present value of its future cash flows. So as the required yield increases, the present value of these cash flows decrease, and therefore as we would have seen before, the price of a bond is a summation of these future cash flows. So if these cash flows are lower, then the summation of these cash flows is lower, and therefore the price of the bond will be lower. So similarly as well, if a yield decreases, then the present value of those cash flows, which are discounted, will increase, thus enabling the price of the bond to increase. So always be mindful that there's an inverse relationship or opposing relationship between price and yield on instruments. And this is where it's reflected by way of a graph here. So prices increase, yields fall. What we also want to mention here as well is when the yields in the market rise above the coupon rate of the bond at any given point in time, then the price of the bond must also adjust. So the investor contemplating the purchase of a bond can realize some added interest. If this were not to occur, then investors will not be induced to buy bonds because it will be below the market yield. So there needs to be some compensating effect that allows for this to take place. And the resulting lack of demand would cause the price of the bond to fall and therefore the bond yield to rise. So if there is a bond that is held to maturity, but the bond is paid off at its par price, then the investor realizes additional interest in the form of capital appreciation. And this capital appreciation compensates the investor for a coupon rate that is lower than the required market yield. So essentially, as yields fall, what you have happening is that the bond price will rise, and therefore at the back end of it, there is this capital appreciation that will take place. So if a bond is selling below its par value, just by way of understanding what's going on, it's selling at a particular discount. And then similarly as well, the opposite would be true. If a bond is selling above its par value, it's selling at a premium. And that premium arises where the required yield in the market below its coupon rate, obviously the bond must sell above its par price. And the investors who have an opportunity to purchase a bond at par will be getting a coupon rate in excess of what the market requires. And therefore, because this is the excess that's going to take place, investors would therefore bid the price up because the yield is attractive and therefore the bond price would particularly fall. Is that clear? Okay. So what I just tried to show here is just in summary position. If you have a coupon rate that's less than the required yield, then the price of the bond will be at a discount, but it will be below its par value. If you have a coupon rate where the required yield, where the coupon rate and the required yield are both equal, then the price of the bond is equal to its par. And if the coupon rate is above the required yield, then the price will be greater than the par price. Therefore, it will be a premium bond. So, and this basically is the tenet of bond valuation. And we would have seen this present value formula below here earlier in the presentation, but it's the exact same thing. Essentially, it's the cash flows or the intermediate interest cash flows that are discounted by its respective interest rate plus the principal at maturity discounted by the interest rate for that principal in its particular time period. So the value of the bond is the present value of its cash flows, which is generated. These cash flows are a series of semi-annual coupon payments with principal at maturity. And essentially, the discount rate used to determine the present value of the cash flows is based upon the market interest rate on risk-free bonds plus the risk premium that is dependent on. And this risk premium is driven by any number of factors, the quality of the security, the time to maturity, the indentures or the provisions contained in a particular bond structure, as well as the exchange rate if you have foreign bonds in particular. So this rate essentially is a capture of all the issues or risk associated with a particular bond to derive its present value. To give you a sense of pricing of money market instruments, which essentially are instruments that have a maturity value of less than 1 year. Money market instruments essentially are treasury bills and other short-term instruments, certificates of deposit, to purchase agreements. Essentially, the price essentially is, as we have demonstrated here. So I think this is a fairly easy example of how to price money market instruments. To give you a sense of how to calculate current yield essentially is the coupon divided by the price of the bond. The disadvantage of this current yield approach is that it fails to take into account the movement of a price of a bond as it moves towards maturity. As you may or may not know, as bonds move towards their maturity time frame, the price of the bond tends to move towards par or $100. And this current yield approach doesn't take into account that particular phenomenon. To give you a sense of how to calculate yield to maturity, the yield to maturity in a bond is the internal rate of return. It is the discount rate that equates the present value of the bond with its price. And this approximation method is essentially how we would calculate yield to maturity. The challenge with this yield to maturity approach is that it assumes that the coupon interest will be reinvested at the same yield over the life of the bond. But as you would appreciate, interest rates in the markets do change over time for a variety of reasons. So this isn't the best way to calculate yield to maturity because it assumes that the reinvestment rate is the same over time, which is usually not the case. Volatility characteristics of bonds is essentially three main factors that drive the volatility within the bonds or in bonds: maturity, the coupon, and the level of interest rates. Long-term bonds tend to be more volatile than short-term bonds, but as I would have mentioned before, bond price volatility increases at a diminishing rate as you get closer to the maturity point of a particular bond. So short-term bonds are not as volatile as long-term bonds, but volatility over time narrows out as you get closer to the maturity point of a particular bond. Coupons. The lower the coupon, the more volatile a bond can and will be. And with respect to interest rates, if volatility measured as a basis point change in interest rates, then the higher the initial level of interest rate, the lower the bond price volatility will be. So as I would have mentioned, factors that affect yields, and yields are determined by two distinct factors, base rates, or what are called benchmark rates, and essentially risk premium. And risk premium can be made up of a variety of factors. Base interest rates essentially, or benchmark rates essentially, is a minimum interest rate that investors will be willing to accept, given that investors will demand for non-treasury securities. So, for example, U.S. Treasury securities are viewed as having zero credit risk or very little credit risk in international markets. This is a result of the size of the U.S. Treasury market, which is seen as the most liquid active market in the world. It constantly issues Treasury securities over time, and are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. And the U.S. government, I think, is still AA rated at this point in time. So it's essentially one of the most liquid risk-free markets that exists over time. And with respect to risk premium, also known as spread, this is the additional risk that an investor faces when acquiring securities that are not U.S. government securities. So this is essentially what is defined as risk premium. So other factors affecting yields are the types of issuers. And the bond markets are made up of very many types of issuers. U.S. government, U.S. government agencies, municipal or town situations, corporations, foreign governments. Each one of these issuers has its own inherent risks and rewards associated. So for example, if you look at the U.S. government at the one end spectrum, then the risk associated with the U.S. government will not be nearly the same as the risk of investing with one of the sovereign nations within the Eastern Caribbean environment. So not to single out any one particular country, but the government of Saint Kitts would be seen as having greater risk than the U.S. government. Creditworthiness of the issuer, again, is another example of factors that could affect yields. So the default or the credit risk associated with the issue of a bond essentially is the inability to make payments on a timely basis of interest and principal back to the investors. So most market participants rely on, again, as you would have mentioned before, commercial credit ratings to assess the default risk of a particular issuer. And the spread between treasury and non-treasury securities that are identical for quality is referred to as credit spread. Also affecting yields is, again, options associated with bonds and liquidity of a particular issue. So if bonds have, for example, a number of options or financial attachments, sometimes known as derivatives or conditionalities, then these conditionalities can all be priced, and therefore, because they can be priced, there can be an associated level of risk that can be defined and measured for what may exist. So the presence of embedded options has the effect on the spread of an issue relative to treasury securities, and the spread relative to these securities does change relative to treasury securities or other securities that do not have embedded options. So the number or the greater the number of embedded options within securities, then the greater the risk associated with those particular securities. And because they're greater risk, then market participants will require a larger spread above riskless treasury instruments to compensate for these options that are available to a particular issuer. So conversely, if market participants require a smaller spread, then the easiest thing is to essentially reduce some of these embedded options. Or you can add other options that are advantageous to the investor. So one example would be a put or put option available in a transaction. By adding a put, which essentially gives the right of the holder of the security to place back into the hands of the issuer the particular security, then that is a way to essentially reduce or mitigate some of the risk associated with holding those particular instruments. So there are options that are available to both the issuer and the investor that allow for the management of risk and yield associated with securities. With respect to the liquidity of an issue, all bonds have a varying degree of liquidity attached to them. The greater the liquidity in a particular issue, which means that you have a narrower bid-ask spread, then the lower the yield that is required by the investor. And of course, the converse is true. The lower the less liquidity that exists within a particular instrument, then the wider that credit spread or that bid-ask spread will be to compensate investors for the lack of price discovery or price transparency. Also, as well, term to maturity also affects yields. As we have mentioned before, term to maturity is tied to the volatility. Again, the longer the term to maturity of a bond, the greater the price volatility associated with changing yields. So what we've tried to demonstrate here is the required rate of return on a debt security is made up of this risk-free rate or this benchmark rate, plus all these other types of risk premium, inflation, default, maturity, liquidity, and any others that you may think about, exchange rate risk, event risk. Anything that maybe that you can factor by way of a risk can be added to the risk premium as a means by which you can determine what is the required rate on a particular instrument for an investor to purchase. Term structure of interest rates or yield curves. This is just essentially a graphical representation of a yield curve over time. So essentially what we have here is short tenors or periods of less than 1 year. I think this is probably about 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, one year, all out to 30 years. And this is the US Treasury curve, which essentially just shows that as you go out in time, the expectation of an investor is that he requires a higher rate of return to compensate for his money being foregone or not being available to him. So again, shorter the term, less risk involved, therefore the lower rate of return that is required. What determines the shape of the yield curve? There are a couple of theories that determine the shape of the yield curve. Expectations theory, market segmentation theory. I don't want to get too heavy into the various types of definitions or subcategories of expectation theories. But what I would mention here is that it assumes that the forward rates in long-dated bonds are closely related to the market's expectation about future short-term rates. So it asserts that there's no systematic factors other than the expected short-term interest rates that affect future rates. So this essentially deals with market efficiency, and therefore what should happen is that your expectation of future interest rates should only be driven by what is currently available in the marketplace with respect about future dynamics, and whatever does exist is reflected quickly in the particular price or yield within the particular market. By way of market segmentation, what this refers to is that investors do have preferred habitats that will direct what investments they do hold or what they do they get into. So what it does suggest is that the major reason for the shape of the yield curve lies in the asset liability management constraints and or creditors restricting the decisions to particular maturity sectors. So if you take, for example, the social security systems in each of our respective countries, they tend to be long-dated investors. They invest for our future benefits. So they would invest 10, 15, 20, 30 years out. So their natural habitat in terms of investment or market segmentation habitat tends to be very long dated, as well as insurance companies, as well as trust companies. Conversely, what you have is that banks or some investors would invest very near term or very short term. And so banks would invest in treasury securities or treasury bills, treasury notes. That may be 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. And that's their investment horizon. So they tend to be segmented from a market perspective at the short end of the curve, and that's where their bias is towards investments. So you have essentially, depending on what investor exists, they may have a particular preference for segments of the particular market. Some investors do, or some institutions do have overlapping segments that they would invest in. And sometimes that is also driven by the availability of investments as well. So think of a mutual fund company. A mutual fund company, for example, depending on the type of mutual fund that it offers or the family of mutual fund products that it offers, may buy a particular segment in a particular yield curve or instruments along that yield curve. So they will buy, for example, medium-term instruments or intermediate-term instruments, as well as short-term instruments or long-term instruments, all depending on the type of investments that do exist in a particular point in time. Okay, guys, I'm actually at the 4 o'clock mark right now. I can actually pause here because I actually go into a particular area here, and we can pick this up tomorrow, I think at our 9 o'clock slot time. So, but what I'd like to do is, if you agree that we should break now, then what I can do is I can just open it up to any particular questions that you may have, and I may be able to provide you with some answers or some more information when we come back tomorrow morning. Is that okay?
Yes.
So any questions from anybody along the way? Anything that was a problem that you'd like me to revisit in the morning to give you some more clarity on?
I'm good.
Anyone else?
Okay, Stephen, I think can't stop here for today. You've given them quite a bit to watch for today, and so we shared the slides this morning, so they will have the opportunity to review them again tonight and come back tomorrow with any questions. So maybe at the start of the session tomorrow, you could probably do a quick recap and whether there are any questions coming out of this session before you continue going to the remaining slides or the remaining sections of the teacher.
Sure, that's fine. That's no problem. All right, guys. So let's break now. Thank you guys again, and we'll pick it up first thing in the morning at 9 a.m. We don't have too much further to go in the presentation, so we can definitely get through the remainder fairly quickly and come back and do any recap that you guys feel that we need to do. So please spend the night looking over some stuff, and we can answer any and all questions tomorrow morning.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Okay,
thank you.
Night. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Thomas. I will now end today's session by saying thank you for your participation, and we look forward to you all tomorrow at 8. 45, please.
Sure, no problem. See you guys tomorrow.
Okay, bye.
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 Bye. Bye.